So we are here, and you mentioned Roger Corman with Charles Band. You're now have become kind of the modern day Roger Corman, and we know this because Roger is such a legend in making. Do we call them B movies? Do we call them low budget movies?
No, exploitation movies. Exploitation. I like that more because that's what they are.
Yeah, exploitation movies. Mm-hmm. That's what you would call them.
Yeah.
So do you feel that now with Roger's passing that you've kind of hit the top of the list?
Yeah, because there was an article years ago, I think it was in Newsweek, and they talked about me and Roger, and he was the king of schlock or something. I was the prince. This is a lot of years ago. But no, we were close for decades, and you know, he just was always so full of, you know, imagination and energy, and you know, just, it's weird that he's gone, but he was 93 or something.
Right.
But I've done exactly the same thing since 1970 frickin' three. The same thing.
Was Roger kind of an early influence on you, or?
No. He was an influence in that he was a young guy who managed to make money in the very unforgiving theatrical business. Because when I started, that was it. That's where the money came from. Mm-hmm. So we were always the B side of a double bill. Mm-hmm. And the more lurid the poster, the better. And Roger did that almost 20 years before me. So he kind of blazed that trail. But when I started that in that arena, then quickly home video began to happen. Oh, and I was the super number one first guy to have an independent home video company. And we released movies on Betamax and VHS.
Was that Empire?
No, Empire wasn't even a thought. This was in the 70s. So it was called Mita Home Entertainment.
Okay.
And then because I got so busy making movies, I just didn't have the time and I had not very nice partners. So I sold my share of the business. But then I started, because I couldn't stay away from home video, Wizard Video, which is well known for those big oversized VHX.
The big plastic boxes.
Yeah. Well, they were cardboard. They were just
big. I remember though, yeah.
That's when the video stores needed product and there was a lot of shelf space. And what killed that sort of little sub business, which was great because it gave you more area to put something crazy to grab the customer, you know? Mm-hmm. It's just they ran out of space. They said, we can't take these big ass boxes anymore. Just do normal.
Yeah.
But that happened. And then I got busy making movies. I had some successes. And Roger and I still stayed close. I mean, we would see each other every year or two and compare notes because I was also into the merchandise and the marketing. He was really strictly making the movies. He was also acquiring movies, like importing films, which I didn't really do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as recently as 2 years ago, I had a podcast and it's a great hour we spent, you know, and he came by himself. He had someone drive him. The guy was like 91 or whatever. Right, and he just walks in there, you know, like, dude, okay.
Yeah. But here you are, and you mentioned Mita, Empire, go to Full Moons is what we have now.
Yep.
And you have created a whole genre of movies, some classics, some not as classic, but here you are 55 years in and still being very profitable as a movie producer through all the different eras and all the different mediums. I mean, how does that even begin to happen?
Just perseverance. And it's, you know, there were really rough spots as well. I mean, this wasn't all like, oh, this is great. And
sure.
I'm just gonna, so, you know, there were times when I wrote a book a few years ago. I'm actually, a sequel's coming out soon. It was called Confessions of a Puppet Master on HarperCollins. And it's done well. And it kind of tells my early story up to maybe just before COVID. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there were great times and there are really times. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you spend a weekend in jail, you know that you have to kind of make some adjustments in your life. So it was all of that, but hanging on, you know. And it's the story of any entrepreneur in any business. I mean, if you step away from movies, you know, I mean, this business happens to be extra wacky because it keeps morphing, as you know, every few years. I mean, I never thought as I lugged those film cans up steps to screen a movie that, you know, now on one drive, I can have 50 of my movies.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, so yeah, it changes, but I'm still essentially making the same movie, you know, entertainment, low budget, fun. Never did a slasher movie, was not into that kind of stuff. So my movies, you know, they can be pretty edgy. If you're afraid of inanimate objects and dolls coming to life, don't stay away.
Puppet Master would be the big, that's your big brand.
Yeah, big brand and made 14 of those over 38 years. And now we've done a deal with a huge Hollywood company for a reboot. Mm. So until they announce that, I'm not supposed to say anything.
Of course.
But it is, we couldn't be in better company.
Well, before we'll delve into the Puppet Master a little bit, and I know you have some merch there. Which
we'll just for
too.
You, some silly
thank stuff. You, I want to check them out. Talk about how you got into the film business and making movies in the first place.
Okay. Well, I'm one of those rare guys who I was actually literally born on a movie set.
Mm.
My dad made movies in the States. Then he took the family to Europe. It was supposed to be a 1-year trip. We were there almost 20 years. So wow. I grew up in Rome. It's my first language, really.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, possiamo fare questa intervista totalmente in italiano se vuoi. Chris, dai.
Grazie.
Well done. Well done. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I grew up with my dad, obviously, and I was in love with the whole process. And this is back at 35 millimeter heavy lifting, you know, grips were grips. It's not today with all this stuff. And so I had all that experience. Plus my dad put me into some of his movies, which I thought was fun that I learned to hate it. I wanted to be the guys behind the camera controlling this shit. I didn't want to like paint my face and curl my hair, but I did 2 or 3. I mean, if you're into that genre, well-known movies, I played the son of Hercules in a movie back in the day. It's ridiculous.
And these are the kind of the Italian ones, right?
Yeah, no, but Steve Reeves, mm-hmm. Mr. Universe.
The classic,
yeah. I mean, I played his son. He's a super cool guy, by the
great.
Way. So I did all that. And then I fell in love for other reasons with sci-fi, fantasy, and horror movies as a young kid. I grew up in Italy. I saw a lot of the classic Italian horror movies. I saw some of the great classic Universal movies. Always in Italian, because, you know, that's where I was. So
right.
I had to come back at age 20 to re-see or look at movies that I had grown up with that were originally American or English films and finally hear the original language. I mean, I didn't know what Boris Karloff sounded like
until
I heard the original, because I heard the Italian dub. So that was my background. And then being super entrepreneurial as a young kid, I did all sorts of crazy shit, I mean, to make money, you know. And then in my early 20s, I started making movies, you know. And failed and made mistakes and couldn't wait to get out of high school. I knew mm-hmm. college was not for me. I didn't go to any business school. So you do enough things that you go, oh, I can't really do that again.
Right.
So yeah, and that's been 50 odd years.
So what was your first kind of big break in making a movie? What was your first one that got a little bit of steam on it?
In my first 7 or 8 movies, all did well enough for me to go back to these thieving distributors and get a little more money to make my next movie. It took a while until I realized that if I'm going to be prolific and make the movies I want to make, I have to control my own distribution. And that was a big leap from making movies like Mansion of the Doomed and Tourist Trap and Daytime Ended and Laser Blast, all these kind of cool movies, Cinderella, where 50 people buck naked, you know, breaking to dance. There was that. And I thought, no, this has got to be, a better way. So I had this movie that because I invent all my movies with few exceptions. I invent the poster, the title. That's kind of how I do it. That's probably why I've never had a lawsuit in my life because they're all my inventions.
So you come up with the invention, like the title of the movie is Puppet Master, and then hire somebody to write a movie called Puppet Master.
Right. Well, what I do, and I'll tell you a story as we get past maybe 30, 40 years here. What I used to do is I would go to a graphic artist, and I had a lot who I became friendly with and say, okay, here's my idea. I want it to be called Dolls. I want this creepy doll to be holding its eyeballs and dolls and give it this kind of a font. So I would describe kind of what I wanted and they would come back with sketches. And then I would finally have someone do a rendering. And that's how I would usually sell the movie to a distributor. Or when I was distributed by Paramount, we would walk in there with 10 of these things and they'd say, oh, that's great. No, not that one. Do the Puppet Master one.
So you would sell these movies based just on the poster alone.
Yeah. And then there was a golden era in the early 80s. When I had a deal with a company that's long gone called Vestron Video, but they were huge.
I was just thinking Vestron Video. Yeah, I remember them. Yeah.
So I finally started going to my own film festivals. So I would go to Cannes. I would go to, AFM wasn't around back then. And I would do exactly that. I'd bring 6 or 7 posters. Maybe one movie had been shot. The other ones were just air.
Wow.
Well, but I had a reputation. They know I can make movies. It wasn't like I was just completely out of thin air. So I would go to these shows and sometimes we would sell millions of dollars. Now, no one gave me all the money up front. It was like, here's 10%. Now you got to deliver the movie. Yeah. You know, you have to kind of do that part of it. But I did that for years. But the breakout movie, and there were several all in a row, is I decided, okay, I can't let these distributors rip me off anymore. And I had enough money. So I made a movie called Ghoulies.
Okay? Yeah.
And, and as I was shooting it, I'm thinking, this may be the movie that we take out theatrically, because it was still a theatrical business. Video was sidebar, but you still needed to make some money theatrically. So I got in touch with through a friend with somebody who handled the East Coast. I won't do the accent, like super New York dude. Been in the business for like 75 years. He was an older guy. He looked at the movie, he said, well, excuse me, you need a really hot campaign. it's a good movie. So let me come back to you with something. So I went to my closest friend at the time, who sadly, like many friends of mine, are gone. Mm. His name was Gary Allen. He was a fantastic campaign poster guy and editor, trailer editor. He's the one who did the first trailer for Star Wars, as an example.
Oh, wow.
He has that pedigree.
Okay.
But it was an insane pot hit, you know, and I'm not. I made 9 Evil Bong movies. I don't smoke weed. So just to put it in perspective.
Evil Bong. I love it.
Yeah, it was one of our big
franchises.
Hits. Yeah, believe it or not. Anyway, so I go to Gary, and he answers the door, and he's got a big smoke and this big cigarette. And he goes, I got a great plan for you. I like the movie. It's really, really cool. How about we have a picture of a ghoulie coming out of the toilet? And the copy line is, they'll eat your ass. I said, Gary, you've smoked too much weed. I said, first of all, I got to get these ads in the New York Times. We're going to be breaking this in Manhattan. So I don't know about the ghoulie out of the toilet, because that seems kind of like they want to prove it. But you can't say that. That's not the copy line.
Yeah.
So anyway, hours later, you know, he mellowed out. I was having some wine. He goes, so I think the ghoulie out of the toilet is still a really good idea if it's done well. But how about this copy line? They'll get you in the end. You know, clever, right?
Yeah, nice.
I said, oh, far out. So then I realized, okay, if I'm going to make this the campaign, I didn't have a shot like that in the movie at all, you know? So I, as the first and only time in my life, I had to go buy a commode, a toilet. I got my effects guy, the great John Buechler.
Oh, this is
we
great.
Shot a shot of the thing popping out of the toilet, and we did the photo shoot. And then I cut that in the movie because the movie wasn't totally done. So at least there's a shot in the movie from the poster, and the poster was the poster. And then last but not least, and I'll get off the subject, and we had 100 theaters booked. So for me, it was a huge deal. I was about 140 grand in prints. We had about 150,000 in print and P&A, I mean, in advertising. It was like a $250,000-$260,000 role. So to me, that was like going to Vegas, putting all your money on red.
Yeah.
It was that.
Yeah.
But the guy was very confident. So we had it all set up. And the final thing after we had the trailer cut, and the poster prepared is I had to go in front of the MPAA and I forget what it was called. I think it's Green Band. I had to get the poster and the ads approved. And then I had to get the TV spots approved. So luckily for me, whoever they're all women back then, older women, but I can be charming if I have to. So it turns out one or two of them were not feeling well. So I was sent to the house of the gal who was in charge and I did my routine. And I said, look, it's gotta be PG-13. Oh, it was before PG-13. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. It's got to be R because I was afraid of anything worse. Mm-hmm. And I really need to be able to run the TV spots everywhere, you know, which she said, well, let me look at it. And I said, it's a comedy. It's ghoulies. They're coming out of the toilet. So I don't know what she smoked or didn't smoke that weekend, but she gave us an approval to run these ads everywhere. So we ran the ads in children's cartoons. We completely put these ads with the ghoulie popping out of the toilet.
Yeah.
At the end of each commercial, all over the place. So there was this buzz going on. So I had an appointment to call my guy. I forget whatever time it was in LA, but it was after the first tour screenings in New York. And we were in 100 theaters. And he goes, and this was like late his time. He goes, Charlie, I got some good news and some bad news. Good news is you have a hit. We turn people away. The theaters are doing a lot of business. You'll probably pull $1 million out of New York, less your cost.
Wow.
The bad news, we already have parents complaining. They are pissed off. They won't. Their little kids can't go to the bathroom, won't take a crap, won't even go near the toilet because they see this monster coming out of the toilet.
Right.
So he said, you have two choices. He said, that's really a stupid story. Two choices. Either you change the campaign, have the ghoulie popping around a closet or coming out of a drawer, or choice two is just them and just keep going because that may be part of the magic. You know, you could take that away and that may be what drives people there. So I chose it and we did great. So a little sidebar to the story. So I don't know, 30 years later, I do this roadshow tour. When video was shitty, I went on the road and I did these performances. I brought horror celebrities. I had William Shatner and all of my friends. They're all doing the shtick. And a good percentage of the audience back then, probably their early to late 30s, many would say, I'm one of those kids. I couldn't go in the bathroom for years. Ghoulies, it f***ed me up. Anyway, but that was my breakout hit.
Well, now, it's funny because not to interrupt you, but I remember renting that movie.
Yeah, right.
Why? Because of the cover.
That's right.
You know, you're thinking like, what are these things? Because it was kind of like it was around the time of Gremlins and you know, Ghoulie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So then now you learn this lesson of the poster.
Yeah.
or also too the movie box, because at the VHS, right.
Sure, that's well, what would, they're the same.
That's yeah. what would stand out.
That's all.
So
it is.
That's a real eye catcher, shall we say? Right.
It was, I learned many lessons for yeah. sure, but that allowed me suddenly a bankroll to just start making movies like a lot. And I haven't really stopped. I mean, there are ups and downs, definitely periods when things got crappy. You know, when the home video business died, which was not that long ago.
Right.
I mean, for people who are too young to know what it was like to go to a video store, I've run into some kids. I go to these conventions, and a lot of times an 8 and 9 year old will come up, and they're only because of the parents. They can't find our movies on Amazon, even though we're there.
Yeah, okay.
Because it's in the basement somewhere. But their parents will say, hey, let's watch Puppet Master. And they get all, and they have questions. So, generally speaking, the fans are I don't know, average age, mid to late 30s. You know, they experience this, and older, way older, at their local video store. So it's tricky today to think, for a lot of young people, to understand what it was like when we went to the video store and there was the horror movie yeah. section, which was huge for me and for yeah. people like me, because that was the only place on earth, other than if you had missed it theatrically, and not all these movies played theatrically, practically none of mine, you could go to the video store. And it was really simple. If you wanted to see a horror movie, you went to the horror section. That was it. You didn't have to go Amazon and Netflix and yeah. Paramount Plus and Hulu and Shpulu and Tubi.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You got to have a chart.
Yeah.
And if you're sitting with your significant other, by the time you spent 20 minutes figuring out, you're just pissed off at each other. In the old days, it was just, you just went to the video store. So this kid, I just reminded myself of this story. So I had a convention. And this probably 8, 9 year old kid who's got an old copy of Puppet Master on VHS. He was with his father, and he was, I could tell, a very bright kid. And hey, how's it going? Oh, I love your movies, and we're about to watch Head of the Family. I don't know how you figure that out. One of my favorites, obscure movie. I said, do you know exactly what this is? He's holding the VHS. He goes, yes, this is a VHS video cassette. I go, absolutely. So do you know what a video store is or was? He goes, yes, that is where old people went to watch movies. If you're 8,
yeah,
you have no clue.
That's right. Yeah. 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 That's the truth.
So part of me will say, part of me is like, how do we bring these kids in? But
yeah,
anyway, Ghoulies turned my world around a little.
So when you're talking about this concept of using this eye-catching poster, what are some of your other favorite posters or movie boxes that you had that did the same
so
thing?
So many. I mean, they're endless. The Puppet Master, obviously, Castle Freak, Head of the Family with the big head.
Castle Freak, I remember that. Yeah, like kind of the Castle Freak on the cover. See, that one
Troll,
comes right in my head.
Reanimator from Beyond, obviously. Gosh. Ghoulies, Trancers, Troll, I said. I don't know, there's many.
So Reanimator is one of yours.
Uh-huh.
That's another huge hit. Like, to me, I understand the Puppet Master series has 14 of them, but to me, Reanimator might be your biggest, you know, kind of classic title, or one of them at least.
Yeah, it was the one that was most critically acclaimed. And that began my great relationship with Stuart Gordon. You know, Stuart, then we did From Beyond, Dolls, which I still think is probably the best doll movie. I don't want to piss off all my Puppet Master movies and friends, but Dolls is really a really, really cool movie with stop motion animation and creepy dolls. And Subspecies was a vampire series that did great. Demonic Toys was huge. We made several of those. Doll Man. The copy line was 12 inches with an attitude. So think, you'll appreciate this. So think of this concept. And you know, all these things come to me at weird hours, and then we make the movies, and some are successful. So imagine being like Clint Eastwood on your planet. You got the biggest gun, and you're and you get in a spaceship, and you chase a bad guy through space, and something goes wrong, and you crash land on Earth. You get out and you're pissed off, and you open it up and you realize you're 12 inches tall, you know, Doll Man. And so it allowed action and crazy stuff, but also humor, you know, because the guy's like this,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, so trying to think what other, well, Evil Bong, I mean.
What's the concept of Evil Bong?
Okay, dude, you don't even need a log line. Yeah. Evil Bong.
Say no more.
I just finished a movie. We screened it literally 2 days ago, which I know is going to do really, really well. And again, the title, you don't need a log line. The title is Models versus Werewolves.
Say no more.
That's it.
There's nothing worse than a movie title we don't know what it's about.
No.
This is not one of those.
And this one turned out great, because we got these, and the girls I cast, they're really talented, young. They're, 3 of the 6 are these vertical stars, so they know their shtick. But it's written really well. So these are sort of vacuous, you know, I mean, one of the girls dies and she's trying to post, you know, she's dying. You know, so it's got that humor.
Yeah.
And we got Dee Wallace in the movie.
Uh-huh.
Who's, you know,
of course, classic
fans love her. Yeah, so she did a cool cameo in the film. So, no, the idea of the lurid poster, which when I started was a theatrical 30 by 40 poster, reduced down to the cover of a video cassette.
Right.
Morphed a bit to the cover of a Blu-ray or a DVD. Now it's a little tricky because sometimes, even though we put the art up on these various sites, sometimes you can also scroll through the titles.
Oh, it's this big too on your phone,
right? Yeah. Well, think of it. When I was a kid and I went to these, I love going to see these weird movies. The poster was 30 by 40.
Yeah.
So you had some chick wrapped in tentacles and her boobies. Everything. And then it kept getting reduced to now it's, you know, as you said. And the worst thing is once in a while when you're scrolling, there's no art. It's just the title.
Mm.
So the title needs to be
clever. Has to be
I don't know what's next.
What the heck is going on with all these promotional popcorn buckets? The giant shorts that all of Gen Z is wearing now? And whatever the heck Hyrox is? I'm comedian and certified hater Matt Bellassai, and these are the types of questions I'm demanding answers to on my podcast, What the Heck with Matt Bellassai. Listen or watch every Thursday as I rant about all the internet trends, pop culture stories, and personal mayhem that makes me scream, What the Heck? Follow What the Heck with Matt Bellassai wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's talk about Puppet Master. I mean, that's obviously one of your big franchises. How did that start out, and how did you get 14 of them over the years?
Well, I always say to people, if any of these movies we make, especially back in the video days, are successful, even marginally successful, we're making a sequel right away. I mean, the characters all die. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's a prequel. Who the fuck, they come back.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, right. Yes, exactly. So, the way Puppet Master, this is an interesting story. I had a company for years in the 80s called Empire.
Mm.
You know, again, that's the Reanimator and From Beyond and Troll and Ghoulies.
And Trancers was a big
was a big, big hit. Yeah. Helen Hunt's first movie. In the early 80s, I did a movie called Parasite. Was Demi Moore's first film in 3D.
Of course, as you do.
Yeah. And anyway, so Empire ended for a bunch of reasons. I had a studio in Rome for 3 years, which was like being a mogul back in the 40s. I mean, it was the ex Dino De Laurentiis' studio he shot The Bible, Barbarella, mm-hmm. 100 Acres, Five Sons. And for a brief period of time, I had the money and I had the connections and I bought it. And we shot a bunch of movies there, like Troll, like From Beyond and Dolls and Crawl Space with Klaus Kinski, all these weird movies. And then like everything that seems good in the showbiz, and it ended for financial reasons. But then I had to sell Empire, got rid of Empire. So I needed to start a new label. And the label idea that seemed to make sense was Full Moon. And the problem with Empire is, A, the bank was very much involved in the financing and in the sort of green lighting of projects. And the whole idea is I wanted Empire to be my home for my movies.
Yeah.
But towards the end, because there were other independents who are having trouble finding distribution, they say, hey, help out this and distribute that and do us a favor. And they kind of pushed me to do that, which ultimately was obviously a big mistake. So I thought, all right, that's done. I survived with some titles. I'm alive, you know, exonerated or whatever I signed, which I always was stupid enough to sign.
Mm.
Let me start a new company. So I started Full Moon. And I needed a first movie, and I had been playing around with this idea of Puppet Master. I didn't even have the title yet. I just kept designing these weird characters that would be puppets. Like the original Six Shooter, I called, it was Six Shooter, but it was a samurai guy. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a cowboy guy. Anyway, I eventually went to my stop motion animator, a guy named Dave Allen, who I'd worked with going back to Laser Blast. And we kind of figured a way to make them all, you know, correct for the 1940s, since it takes place in the 40s, and the Puppet Master has these stringless marionettes and blah, blah, blah. So we came up with this idea. I didn't have the name of the title. I didn't have the title yet, but it was time to meet with Paramount and sell them on my first movie and say, this is what we're making. And then for whatever reason, I had made a movie years before that called Dungeon Master with Richard Mull, who became famous with Night Court, and a bunch of cool directors. I thought, Dungeon Master, it seems like that master, something good about Puppet Master. Just why not?
Yeah.
And it's about a puppet master. So I went in there. They loved it. I made the movie in super fast. And it was one of the biggest
directed videos. And the puppets come to life and do murderous things.
Yeah, no, but they're basically good puppets. Oh. You know, they kill Nazis, you know.
Okay. So
they do murderous things, but they drill through Nazis. Cut and
killing
do.
Villains,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. So that's kind of the basic theme. So it was such a hit for in direct-to-video for Paramount. This was in 1990. This is the beginning when things were crazy, that I made a fantastic deal, even though it wasn't financially a good deal, because the more I got as an advance to make more movies, the more they took, till finally I was like, wait a minute, I'm just working for them. There's nothing left here.
Yeah.
But it was a 4-year run and made, I don't know how many, 40 movies. And what was cool is another close friend of mine who's recently gone is Stan Lee of Marvel Comics. Yeah. So Stan and I would hang out. And as a kid, back literally in the 60s, I would find, you know, I bought all the early Marvels, Fantastic Four, number one, the Hulk, Spider-Man. I was there on the newsstand, you know, grabbing these things. And I loved the artwork so much. And I was a fan of science fiction and fantasy. And I loved what they were doing versus what DC used to be, you know, sort of the old school Batman and Superman and Lois Lane. I liked the new twisty stuff. But I couldn't figure out why I liked certain artists and look forward to certain stories until Stan Lee, back in the 60s, created something at the back of each comic called Stan Lee's Soapbox. And what it was a little area where he said, hey, I'm glad you guys, you know, it was like a fan-based thing, which no one did. Glad you guys like Fantastic Four number one, Reed Richards this. And by the way, Steve Ditko is inking the new Spider-Man, and Jack Kirby is going to do the new Fantastic Four. And suddenly I was led into this little bullpen, literally, of the artists that worked for Marvel that, you know, sort of reported to Stan Lee. And I love that idea as a fan. So a million years later, I'm starting this big deal with Paramount. Puppet Master was great. We shot Subspecies. We shot Demonic Toys. I thought, well, I got to do the same thing. So I created what we called the Video Zone. And it was a 20-minute video magazine that was at the end of every VHS cassette.
Ah.
And it let fans into how the effects were done, the next movie, interviews with the actors. All this became commonplace 10
years
later. Yeah, it's
like a DVD extra, but prior to that even existing.
I was the first human to do that. And people loved it. We'd be getting letters. Sometimes the letters would say, we just watched Subspecies 3, and it's not as good as the first one, but the Video Zone was great. You know, when are you going to come out with Doll Man? So that was, and it was free to the fans, obviously. Yeah. And you had to know to get to the end of the VHS to start the 20-minute program. And even Paramount, they were like dicks at the time. They said, well, how are we going to monetize? I said, it's for the fans. But because I was saying, you got to put a little blast on the box that says, watch for the Video Zone. Otherwise, you won't know shit.
No.
So they eventually did that. And the only way they monetize is people were happier to rent more because they appreciated the movie. Not that, because they said it cost us another 7 cents for the tape or some stupid conversation. So yeah, that was artwork, but it's all artwork. It's all the poster art. And it's still the same today.
So Puppet Master, you release it, becomes a hit.
Yeah.
How does that lead to 2 and 3 and 5 and 7 and 8?
We kept making them as long as there was money. You know, I mean, it's rare to hit something that does so well. It is. I mean, generally speaking, my movies have done well. And what's cool is they really withstand the test of time, because a lot of the movies that I made a long time ago are still popular today because they're sort of timeless. They're not like, oh, that's an 80s movie.
Yes.
They're kind of, you know, I could have shot it yesterday. That's also because I never followed what everyone was doing back then was, oh, you got to make a Friday the 13th movie. You got to make a slasher movie. You do a Halloween ripoff. And so I never made any of those movies. I just kept making my own weird ass movies. Some of them I'm really proud of. Some of them didn't turn out like I would
It's amazing though, that coming through in the 80s that you never did a slasher movie, because that was the trope for
And it would
movie.
Have been profitable and easy. My movies always wound up, you know, with stop motion and creatures, and it's much easier to get a guy with a knife chasing people. But to me, it was like, and then there was another era back then called erotic thrillers. And the erotic thriller had some sexy shit going on, and then the chick would be stabbed in her boobs or something stupid. And I thought, well, why? I don't want to do that. I don't want to think of it. I don't want to see it. It's just not appealing. Yeah.
So when you're talking about the first Puppet Master in 1990, 14 was, when did that release?
3 years ago, okay. Something like that.
So talk about, and this is a perfect way to ask this question, how the movie business has changed since you started, which obviously we're not even talking about 70s. Let's talk about the Puppet Master in 90 to the Puppet Master in 24. How does that change as far as how do you make them? How do you distribute them? How do you cast them?
All right. If anyone sends money, send it to Chris, because this is like better than going to film school. Okay, I'll give you the quick, and it doesn't have a happy ending. So sort of, what do they say today? A warning, a trigger warning. Trigger warning, not a happy ending. All right, so starting in 1990, it was a, you know, if you had talent and if you, you know, could make a credible exploitation movie, in my case, I can't talk about love stories or art films, or, and if you found a distributor who was honest, you had a chance of recovering your probably $200,000 to $400,000 budget, which is what you needed to spend back then for anything credible. There was no shortcuts. It was 35 millimeter. Mm-hmm. You know, we were miserly with little short ends. I mean, you know, there was a whole process. Why were you able to make money if things worked out well is because the math was incredibly simple. It was VHS, and later maybe you would sell it to some TV local station, right. But there wasn't much money. This is before streaming and cable and all that shit. So the way it would work is, just for simple math, VHS cassettes wholesale were about $30, $30. Now they came down eventually a bit. And
you mean talking about just to buy the actual tape?
Just to buy the tape if you're a retailer.
Gotcha.
Remember, in the 70s, and I started, I told you, the first home video company, the concept of rental did not exist. The few stores that were popping up, that you want to buy French Connection, well, it's $49.95.
Yeah.
It's yours forever.
Yeah.
And then a few years into that, stores started renting it for $3, $4. They figure if I rent it 20 times, I'm going to make money. Mm. For a while, the studios were pissed off. They sued these chains.
Wow.
Until they realized, well, wait, there's a whole bunch of money in this. Oh, no, sue. We'll go with you. So by then, that's where the money was. The retailer would buy these movies, sometimes two or three copies if they think would be a hit, rent them sometimes hundreds of times, so the tape burned up. Mm-hmm. And that's the model. So as a filmmaker, you knew that if, and I'll make Paramount as an example, but even if it was a smaller distributor, you made a movie, they shipped 30,000 units, at $30 a pop, that's $900,000, less returns, less this, less a charge, less bullshit, less that. But maybe you netted $450,000 and you split with the studio, or there was some split. That's all the math you needed. Mm. You didn't need to know anything else. Mm-hmm. And movies, and I luckily made a bunch of them that really hit. You know, I did a movie, some people remember if you're older, but I did a movie around the, exactly around the time of Jurassic Park called Pre-Hysteria. It's like Honey, I Shrunk the Dinosaurs. I created a sister label that Paramount distributor called Moonbeam. And people were saying, you got to make these like Harry Potter-esque type movies because kids can't see Jurassic Park because people are being eaten in the toilet. So make, you know, Jurassic Park light, you know, make something. So I made Pre-Hysteria. It was the biggest direct-to-video hit of that year. I got it awards and all this phony baloney stuff. And it shipped 120,000 units. You know, that's like almost $4 million.
Huge,
yeah. It's huge. Those are exceptions. So anyway, so as a filmmaker, even if someone is cheating you, you can go in, you can see today, gone. You know, physical media is for collectors. It's tiny.
Yeah.
So we make probably, and you know, we've had a channel for 9 years on Amazon. We were one of the first, and we're lucky to have
Full Moon Channel,
right. 9 years, Amazon. How come we're not making tons of money? Well, because you have to know that it's there.
Yeah,
it's
right.
It's called discoverability.
Yeah.
It's finding where the movie is or where the channel is. Mm-hmm. So we're doing some things recently that hopefully will elevate it a bit. But if you're on Amazon or Netflix or wherever you are looking or surfing around for a movie, unless you see it in the first, I don't know, 20, 30 rows, by then you're just pissed off. You have another drink and you're gone.
Yeah.
So unless you know to look for it, I want to see this movie, boop, 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 and you find the thing. That didn't happen in the video stores because there weren't that many horror movies and it was on one shelf.
You said it was a horror section.
Very simple.
Yeah.
But our average amount of money we get per view on Amazon streaming is 6 cents.
Yeah.
So compare that to the couple of dollars, $3.
You know? It's the same. Lloyd Kaufman had the same issue talking about how it's the same
Lloyd
thing.
Lloyd and I go back the same time.
Yeah. See, you guys are old school filmmakers, but it's the same thing with rock and roll. I mean, you could have one of our songs has 90 million streams,
right,
which equals, you know, $10,000 or whatever the hell it is. It's just like, how does the revenue get so small? So with that question in mind, then how can you make it profitable if you're getting 6 cents a view?
Here's where we're getting into the bummer news. Okay. I would say of the last 20 movies I've made, and I'm on a new role right now, so we'll see if things change. Maybe two made money.
Hmm.
And I make them less expensively than ever. The technology helps, obviously,
sure.
You know. Why? It's just because of these numbers I'm telling you. So the reason why it works for Full Moon, and you can't pluck an individual movie and go, what about this movie? It was so cool. You made it for $113,000, which is nothing. How can you survive? It only made 19 grand. How does that work? It works because I've made 418 movies.
Yeah.
So I've got a big ass library.
Yeah.
I have the whole library, most of the library on Tubi, which does well. It doesn't do well. Pluck one movie out. Oh, they made 80 bucks. But I've got hundreds and hundreds.
Yeah.
You know,
big picture.
Same thing with Amazon. So what the new movies do is they keep the brand alive.
Right. You know? Good thinking.
And they also help sell merch. We have a really good merch business. I mean, it ebbs and flows, but recently it's been amazing. Collectibles, people want to collect shit from the good old days. So yeah, and that's, you know, good for, and still it's not easy, you know, to pay your bills. And I have, you know, 8 people and I have offices and we go to Italy to shoot, we go to Cleveland to shoot, but it kind of works out. And then I'm always trying to find a way to get these movies to try to recover their cost a little more with new tricks and new ideas. Mm-hmm. We'll see. We've got a few in the hopper right now, but it's only because of the brand loyalty in the library. Because I've been doing this for a long time.
See, that's the thing. You said the brand loyalty. You could have your own Full Moon Film Festival, or you have.
I've done that a few times, and we reach. I mean, I don't overdo it. I mean, as a fan myself, I hate getting fucking emails every 2 days from somebody trying to sell me shit. So we have a lot going on. Maybe once every 10 days, we'll send something or promote something or solicit something. But we reach 100,000 loyal fans very easily, you know, in our little universe.
Mm-hmm.
And then I recently started a Patreon thing, which is mm-hmm. really cool. And you guys, whoever watching this, listening to this, check it out. Because what I've done, again, I don't think it's unique, but I did this years ago before Patreon existed. So I didn't want to have 20 tiers and a dollar here. So we have literally 2 tiers. One is $25, where every month the fans or the subscribers get a choice of 2 Blu-rays. So that's already more than $25.
Yeah.
Every movie we're shooting now, we are live streaming behind the scenes. Not a package thing. I'm saying they can go on set with me if they can stand it for 10 hours, and they can watch everything from blood, guts, boobies flying,
and
whatever.
Some people will watch that.
They love it. Yeah, no, I can't even imagine. But people love it. Well, they don't know. I know. Yeah. I grew up on a set. But to be able to watch how it's done and the camera, and then some actresses upset and boobies aren't coming out and whatever. Whatever
people
it is.
People like the experience.
So we can do that. And then we give gifts. We do crazy shit. So for $25, you really get your foot in the door. And it's just full.
And that helps with expenses.
But if you're loaded with lots of dough, we have a $250 tier. It's the only other tier. And this has been, again, maybe we have 40 people. It's not like we have an army of humans. But you get all the goodies. You get the free stuff. You get access. But the cool part is you get on every movie an executive producer credit. Now, it sounds ridiculous, okay? But I have a few of these guys who I see it. They go, Charlie, I just know my grandchildren are going to watch whatever the movie is. And there I am, executive producer.
You make up your own story.
And they get up. Well, and I gave them already ideas for stories. If you're a young kid, just go to a bar. And when you're introducing yourself to a woman, if you still can, because people don't know how to talk to other people. They said, what do you do? He said, well, I'm many things, but I'm also an executive producer. And the chick would go, oh, bullshit. And you go, boop, 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 IMDb. Here it is. Check it out. Oh, my God. You made Puppet Master 12?
I did. Speaking of your merch, you've got some merch. Yeah. Let's check some of this out.
I have, you know, next time come to my office.
Yeah.
Because we have endless merch. I just, some oddball things. So obviously, a Blade bobblehead is good.
So this is the main guy.
This is the main character of the Puppet Master.
From the Puppet Master, right? Because I remember seeing this guy like on all the Blade
bobblehead.
Here's
another main guy. This is Torch bobblehead.
Oh my gosh, this is great. See, this stuff is perfect for merch.
Yeah, it is.
You know?
Well, it's, as they say in the old days, it's toyetic because most of my characters are just that.
They're toys. They're puppets.
Recently, we kind of cashed in on the Labubu. So we created LaBlade, which you can put on your backpack. It's a backpack charm.
The Labubu.
You know, it's funny. I asked a fellow in my office who's been with me. All my guys have been with me for freaking ever. Greatest team ever. I said, Bob, give me a smattering of shit so I could bring it to the thing. So he had 3 of these bags full. I said, I can't walk in like an idiot. Go, here's all my shit. But anyway, then we have this really successful series. It's a blind box series called Tiny Terrors. It's all our main characters. You don't know what you're getting. Yeah, we're almost sold
out.
This
is good stuff, man. This could sustain the studio.
You got it right.
That's amazing, man. Yeah.
And then just for fun, we have so many lunch boxes, but I just figured this one's pretty cool. So this is a Demonic Toys lunchbox.
I don't think I've seen a lunchbox in years.
Oh, we got plenty.
Use this.
You know what our most successful one is? And I didn't have one at the office. Evil Bong.
Evil Bong.
Evil Bong. And then I've made almost 420 movies, and this is a catalog of maybe the top 100. Just, you know, you can leave through it.
That's amazing.
You know, I've made some weird ass.
So let me ask you, what's the difference between a demonic toy and a Puppet Master puppet?
I beg your pardon. What's the difference? It's too different. Now, we're crossing them over, but they're different stories, you know? Puppets are World War II marionettes that are generally good. They kill Nazis and, you know, they can avenge, whereas the demonic toys are, I mean, the lead demonic toy is, her name is Baby Oopsie, and she cusses her head off.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, you'll have to.
I do like this, though. We got Evil Bong.
Yeah.
Evil Bong 2, King
yes.
Bong.
Yes.
Evil Bong 3, The Wrath of Bong. Evil Bong 4, 20, obviously. Ginger Dead Man versus Evil Bong.
Big one, because that's another series.
Crossover, Ginger Dead Man.
Ginger Dead Man, we've made five of those. And you know who played the pissed off cookie in the first one?
Who?
Gary Busey.
Oh my gosh.
Figure that out.
That's the role he was born to play.
Well, working with him, that was a whole situation.
Because he's a little bit off his rocker, right?
Take the word little bit. Yeah. But he's great as a pissed off cookie.
And then we've got Evil Bong High Five, yep. Evil Bong 666, yeah. Which I think Darcy was in one of the, that
She's
one.
She's been a couple.
Yeah. Evil Bong 777, Evil Bong Infinity 8, and Evil Bong-a-thon.
Yes.
Yes. So you mentioned Gary Busey. Talk about some of the other big names that you've had in, or like you mentioned Demi, well, her first movie.
A young, beautiful 20-year-old Demi Moore was in a movie that I directed and made called Parasite.
Yeah.
In 3D. It was during the resurgence of 3D.
And that was a big thing at the time.
It was. Then it kind of petered out. Then it became super big and big theatrical movies were made. And still sometimes are. The irony is I lost the vision in one of my eyes because of... There's a word for it. I forget. My retina detached.
Okay,
they couldn't right figure.
Yeah.
So, you know, luckily you don't really see it. It's not like I have an eyeball hanging out, but it's hard to see. So I can't see 3D anymore, but I've made two very successful 3D movies. One is Parasite. The other one was called Metal Storm, The Destruction of Jared Sin.
Oh, I remember that movie.
Yeah. That was Paramount.
Okay. That was like,
that was Universal.
Mid-80s, right?
Early 80s.
This is when all the apocalypse movies were big. And
well, here's what happened. Parasite did well. I thought, okay, I got to make a big kind of Star Wars type movie, more like Mad Max. That was my inspiration.
Yeah, right. Road Warriors, yeah.
And came up with the idea and pieced it together. I had a really good cast. The co-lead was a young girl named Kelly Palzis. And during the film, I told Kelly, she's a young, pretty girl, I said, Palzis is not a great name. So she changed it to Kelly Preston.
Oh,
and then
man.
Became, and poor thing, you know, she married John Travolta and she died of breast cancer.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, but that's
one of
Metal
Storm. One of the big starlets of the 80s, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. A sweet girl. There's that. I made a movie called Prison, which is actually a really terrific movie. It was Viggo Mortensen's first film. There's a lot of behind the camera people, too. I'm not going there. I'm just talking about people that most people would know.
On camera.
I made a movie called Troll that had a crazy cast, but it had Julie Louis-Dreyfus.
And this is not related to Troll 2, is it?
Troll 2 was a piece of shit.
So it's the worst movie ever made.
Right. So here's what happens when no one has scruples. They're just a bunch of bastards. So I essentially sell my interest in Empire in 89 and quickly became Full Moon and did Puppet Master. By virtue of doing that, I retained the rights to a few movies. It was part of the negotiation. But otherwise, 20-odd movies that I really cared about were owned and are still owned by someone else. Eventually, MGM wound up owning those movies. It's in their library, which now, of course, is owned by Amazon. You know, so the thing morphs endlessly. So Troll went with the sale of Empire. And there was a fellow, again, all these people are long gone. I mean, it's weird to be, I feel like I'm a vampire. I keep rolling and doing shit. And all my friends are in their 30s. And I look in the mirror and say, oh, not too bad. Not too bad.
Yeah, doing all right.
But a lot of the guys I grew up with who made movies are literally gone, as in they checked out.
They all took
a powder.
Right.
But there was a guy there. It was a European fellow that I knew. And his name was Edward Sarlou. He was a sweet guy. And he owned a bunch of really bad Italian movies. You know, that he said, well, I'm going to try to put them out through the new Empire. Empire stopped being called Empire. And I forget, they created, I think it was called Epic. They made another company for the movies that the bank then owned.
Mm-hmm.
And one of his movies, I forget the original name. It wasn't Troll 2. It was whatever, some name.
Goblins or something.
Like
Nilbog.
Something really bad.
Yeah.
And so they go, well, we're going to release this as Troll 2. I couldn't do anything. I mean, I was out of that game.
You sold it.
I sold it. And I said, Edward, I said, people really love Troll. It's well made. This is a I wish I could tell you this in Italian because it was a great expression. I said, this is a flaming piece of shit. People are going to be pissed off.
Yeah.
Because they're going to think it's a sequel. There's nothing alike at all. Zero. Couldn't care. And they actually did some sales that were pretty good based on
Troll.
Troll 2.
Yeah.
But that's really dumb. I'll tell you, actually, this reminds me of the best. Ask me this question. What was the most successful movie you ever brought to a foreign film festival?
Was the most successful movie, Charles, you ever brought to a foreign film festival?
Okay, I can't help myself. Wow. Okay, so I was being egged on, and this is apropos famous people. I was being egged on by all the buyers who were doing, I mean, we did really well in the 80s. I would go with Dolls, and we would pre-sell $600,000 of sales. Germany, 150, UK, 200, Japan, this, that, and the other. Get a deposit, make the movie. Obviously, we made good movies, and people loved them. If not, they would never come back to our booth, right? So, you know, we did deliver. But I was hearing endlessly, you got to make an action movie. I didn't make any action movies. You got to make an action movie. Make an action movie, guns, blood, lots of tits. You got to do this. So I thought, all right. And then the word came back and I was at, and it was a can again. And I had my guy saying, you got to get Linda Blair. Mm. Linda Blair. Oh my God. I said, Linda Blair, she was a kid 20 years. And no. She's still beautiful. And Linda Blair in an action movie. All right. So now let's go back to Edward Sarlouis, the guy who did Troll 2. He also owned a bunch of films that were made in South America somewhere. I forget. Maybe it was Argentina. They were actually well-made, and they're always about women in chains, women in trouble, guys whipping women, boobies flying. But, you know, there's always women in trouble, women in chain, whatever. He said, I can sell you two of these movies for 10 grand. He said, I've already sold Latin America, but I can't do much with them. Maybe you can cobble them together and make a movie. So that appealed to me, you know. I mean, that appealed to me. So I remember I was my dad at the time. I was the sweetest man. We're sitting watching this. He would look over me like the fuck are we watching? Not like today. You can scroll and scan. Right. We sat there. We had a little screening room. And we had to sit for 85, 90 minutes twice to watch these movies. But I saw in there that there was a kernel of an idea that we could maybe. Anyway, so I came up with an idea called, a movie idea called Savage Island. And and I knew that I could get Linda Blair for one day for $25,000.
Oh, that's amazing.
So my idea was, and one of my closest friends still today, Ted Nicolau, he helped write it and directed this thing. The idea was chick escapes the bad guys in the jungle, goes to Mr. Big somewhere in LA in a skyscraper, goes up there with a hidden gun, confronts him on how he's tortured all these women and kills them. But in discussing it and telling him what she saw and how she was treated, flashbacks. So it was an 80-minute movie, maybe 10 minutes of Linda Blair and the guy in the elevator and the death, and 70 minutes of, as she tells the story, the women, they're getting raped, they're getting flogged. That was the movie. We took it to Cannes. The poster, you can look it up right now. It's called Savage Island, and it's Linda Blair with a gun, and she's ripped up, and there's gringos behind her and girls screaming. We pre-sold $1 million.
Oh, my gosh.
$1 million. More successful financially than any movie I've ever made. Because the whole movie cost like 80.
Yeah, yeah. I love those stories of someone showing up for a day.
It was a day.
That's how you do it.
That was it. Linda Blair, she couldn't have been nicer. And I remember we paid her, I think it was 25 grand, super nice lady, but we also had to contribute something to PETA because she's a big PETA.
Right. To this day. You see her at a convention, she's wearing like a PETA shirt.
Oh, really?
Dog.
I miss that. But yeah, that's one of those. I have many one day adventures with that. Well, but Gary Busey was one day.
Talk about
for
one day to be
Ginger Dead Man.
Yeah.
So the deal with Gary was, and I forget the amount, it was probably in that realm. These interesting stories, I'm thinking, this is pretty silly stuff.
Right,
anyway.
It's great.
So the idea of Ginger Dead Man was, and there's a sidebar again that's actually pretty sweet. So Ginger Dead Man's story is young girls in a bakery, the mom's kind of a drunk, she's, you know, hanging on to, and the brother's with her, and they have a hard time, and there's this diner in front, and the bad guy, Gary Busey, comes in, asks for the money. She's hiding. The brother kind of confronts him. He kills the brother. She freaks out. And this is all the first 3-4 minutes of the movie. So that's Gary Busey's only scene. Mm. But the deal was he would come back and be the voice of the cookie. It's a critical part. But in the story, you read in the paper that his mother, a witchy mother of Gary Busey's character, she takes the ashes, she does something hocus pocus, and it's late at night, she sneaks in the back door and puts the ashes in the gingerbread batter. The young hot chick cooks it up. Next thing, lightning, weird shit. It's in the oven, comes out a pissed off Gary Busey cookie. So the young girl, 20-year-old Robin Sidney, who we did many movies with, yeah. who's a real sweetheart. She and I have been together 22 years, mm-hmm. and we married 2 years ago.
Right.
So she comes from Ginger Dead Man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so that was a one-day gig for Gary. And then he came back and he was the voice, you know, yeah, sucker. He's like the little
puck. So as we start to wind down, I mean, you've kind of said it. What are your most successful movies? Obviously, the Savage Island, and we've talked about
Well, Rihanna.
What's your biggest movies that are still kind of the cornerstones of your...
Well, the biggest movie? Ones are the series, really, you know, gotcha. Even though they were never designed. I never thought I'd be making 14 Puppet Masters,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But Puppet Master, Trancers, you know, we have another big company again, Sworn to Secrecy, doing a reboot.
Wow.
Again, it's really cool until they make a bad movie. So hopefully mm-hmm. they'll make a good movie. But the Puppet Master thing could be amazing because the people who are involved are...
Well, it's got name value too. And in this day and age, that's what studios are looking for. They put out a reboot of Puppet Master. People are going to go there.
Even people never even watch horror movies have heard of Puppet Master. Yeah, so it's one of those titles that... I mean, I go to a show and it's half of it is about Puppet Master.
Yeah, it's got value. Yeah.
Yeah. So I would say all the series. And then there's a few oddball movies. I made a movie which I would recommend to everyone called Head of the Family.
Yeah, talk about this. You mentioned it a few times.
It's hard to even describe it. It's so unique. It's good. You should immediately.
What's on the cover of the box?
A big oversized head in a wheelchair with little arms. And he's got some, and his siblings are all normal, but they're not that normal. Like the chick, her superpower, she got big boobs, the other guy's big eyes, and the other guy's a muscle guy.
Yeah.
So he has most of the brains, and his siblings do what he wants them to do.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And it's really freaking unique and cool. I mean, a lot of movies you can say, oh, that was pretty cool, but that's kind of like this, kind of like that. There's nothing like that with Head of the Family. There's no other movie at all that's even similar, but it's clever. It's well written, well directed. That's one of the oddball. Tourist Trap is another one that's many
classic.
Years ago.
Yeah, classic one.
Chuck Connors. And as a matter of fact, I do this thing. Have you heard about the Church of Chills?
Because Diana. Yeah, in Cleveland or something, right?
Yeah, Darcy appeared with Joe Bob. So what I decided to do, are we okay to talk about this for a minute?
Yeah, sure.
I don't know. I'm just rambling.
Of course.
So about 8-10 years ago when video died, and you know, it's weird to have a business that dies. Like, goes to zero. Mm-hmm. You can point to many businesses. Oh, the toy business, you know, and the Toys R Us. It's not what it used to be. It's different. It's changed. But people still like toys.
Right.
For people who are too young and listening to this, they'll never walk into a video store again. They'll never go into a Blockbuster again.
Yeah.
Because it's gone.
Yeah.
There was a day when it ended. So it wasn't like, oh, there's 30, 80 left.
Right, it's done.
It was done. Yeah. It was like zero, done,
video
gone.
Video cassette rentals are done.
Gone.
Yeah.
So, and that was our... pretty much our only source of revenue. So to be in a business with, you know, at that point I had 90 employees. I had a Romanian studio for years. I had my, I mean, I was like.
You had a castle suddenly, in Italy that you filmed.
Yeah, the castle, that's true. But that was not, yes, I did have a castle. Right. I did shoot some movies. I shot Pit and the Pendulum there, Castle Freak, a few other shows.
Right.
What else? Anyway.
This is a castle that you owned.
I owned the castle for many years. Smart, and like things that come and go, it was time when I couldn't afford it anymore and I sold it.
You right, know, right,
and that's
right.
Life in the big city.
So going back to the video cassette, though.
Yeah. Thanks. Thank you for the video cassette. So I had to invent a way to keep the brand alive
because
we weren't on streaming. Wasn't happening, even though I was the first guy on Amazon with a streaming channel. But that was in between.
It was like video on demand.
It
for
was
a while,
yeah, and I did a bit of that. So the only thing I could think of doing was going on the road like a rock and roll band,
right?
The church later doing what I called the Full Moon Road Show. And in many cases, like in Dallas, for instance, we were there twice or three times. It was like, I would bring props. I would cut heads off, smoke. I would do reenactments. I get people on stage. I get girls to take their tops off, show their boobs, which today sounds terrible, but it was fun back then. I would always have celebrity guests, whether it's Barbara Crampton or Corman or William Shatner came a couple of times. And that way we had would fill a club up with 300 people. And some of the bigger venues, which were theaters, were 800-900 people. So we reached over, I did almost 200 of these over 3 years. So it was like literally banned on the road here.
It's like a live event.
We connected with the fans. People enjoyed it. We sold merch, you know, and it did help. You know, it was a lot of work and it just kept the doors open.
But that's the way of the world now. You got to go on the road and do the cons the films.
So, and I don't... remind me of what you just said, because I don't know if you know, I have a rock and roll son who had number one hit. There's a whole story there.
Yeah.
But as it relates to Church of Chills, so here it is, 10 years later, I'm in Cleveland. I bought a crazy house there. We've made over 30 movies there. It's a great place. Locations are incredible. I mean, just here in LA, if you even dream of shooting in a cemetery, you get 400 permits. It's 10 grand. We just shot in a cemetery outside of Cleveland. It was a Spielberg-esque, gorgeous cemetery. The permit was $25, and we gave the caretaker a couple Full Moon movies. So I'm just saying, we fly there.
Yeah, it's a different world.
It's a different world. Old houses. I mean, a phenomenal place. And about 2 years ago, I'm going to make this really short. 2 years ago, I needed a warehouse. I needed a place where we could shoot some green screen. And my real estate guys, who became part of the family, friendly, that go, instead of that, do you ever consider buying a church? I go, as opposed to a warehouse? They said, well, because there are some really cool churches. Some of them are going for very little money, and they usually have a big open area. You can do your green screen there. Isn't it more interesting owning a church than a warehouse?
Yeah.
Anyway, I've been lucky somehow with real estate and being at the right place at the right time. Found this incredible 140-year-old stone church, not huge, but about 5,000-6,000 square feet, the main area, and then a similar size in this creepy basement. Bought the church, cleaned it up, shot a couple of movies there. And then I thought, well, okay, I own a church. I didn't spend a lot of money. What can I do with this thing? Then I thought, oh, I should do like the roadshow once a year or twice a year. I'll invite guests.
Yeah.
Now we can live stream it, so we have more people. And it only seats 160 people, so it's a pretty small gathering. But the place is incredibly cool. So we did this now 3 times. The next one's coming up in October. Yeah. John Carpenter and I are tied together, and he's going to be beamed down by satellite because he never leaves his room. But he'll be there for an hour, answered questions. I'm screening Tourist Trap, the original uncut Tourist Trap. Every time we do that, I sell VHS cassettes of the movies just for the fans.
Of course.
Jocelyn Jones, who was the star of Tourist Trap, is coming. She's still around, and that's going to be cool. Chuck Connors would appear, but he's dead, so that's a problem.
I can't make that happen.
So here we are, Church of Chills, October 11th, Carpenter, Tourist Trap, merch, and I'm up there doing the same thing I did 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me give you the rock and roll thing.
Right.
Just for a second, because we're talking about how rock and roll's become, live performances.
What song did your son have?
Okay, so my son still has a band called The Calling.
Calling, right.
He toured with Santana. They had 3 number ones. Yeah. The big one was called Wherever You Will Go.
Right.
If anyone hears the song, oh my God.
You know it.
Yeah, you know it in a heartbeat. Like everyone in showbiz, he had a hard time. He was signed to RCA. They did 3 million CDs in the first 6 months. Mm-hmm. He had good and bad, lots of money. 2 wives later, luckily he's married to a fantastic woman. Yeah. The business died.
Right.
No one sold CDs anymore. Mm-hmm. So he struggled and stayed alive and luckily made money on publishing. And now in the last, literally the last year, he got signed to Virgin. He's touring again and his whole career is being resurrected. But the only money he makes is touring.
Is touring, yeah.
That's it. That's the whole.
We're all t-shirt salesmen now.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the whole game. So there you go.
Same with movies as well.
Yeah.
Last couple of questions, Charles. So what is the future of not just for Full Moon, but for the movie business? Can it be sustained? Oh, can it be sustained the way that it is now? Not the whole, don't tell us the whole overall, but for an independent company, you guys are bigger than independent, but you have a big name value. How do you continue forward in the future?
Well, again, we're lucky in that I have this library, when things got tough.
Right.
I sold everything.
Yeah.
I mean, poor guy, he sold a castle. Okay. But I sold everything. Every piece of art I had, just to survive and to keep the team alive. I did that. The one thing I did not sell, thank the heavens, is my library, because that was tempting. So when streaming came back, which is different, suddenly I had, hundreds of movies, and that literally put me back in business.
Yeah.
So thank God for that. That kind of in a roundabout way addresses your question in that, well, how does somebody today with a movie or two, what's the future of movies? I got lucky because I've been around. I'm a fighter and I got this library.
You got history.
I got the history and I got the label. The problem is, and it's not a problem, it's just everything's morphing into something different. You got the vertical world, which I experimented with. We'll see where that goes. I don't see that replacing. It's just another way people watch movies. Mm-hmm. We have a young audience that are on their phones way too much. Attention span is zero. There's nothing there. Some of these kids, I have so many young people in my world because of family and friends. Some people think like a 90-minute movie is like 50 TikToks. There's it's a frame of reference. So if you have short attention span and you're in the phone, and now we have not just AI, but we have all this robotic stuff about to happen. Mm-hmm. And the predictions from people who I read and believe is that within literally a few years, the AI sex robot business, and I made a movie just about that that's in post right now called Robotica. The AI sex robot business will eclipse the revenue of theatrical motion pictures.
Wow.
And that's billions of dollars.
Wow.
Why is that? It's because young kids, and it's more men than women, they have these bot friends or whatever they're called. There's a word that escapes me. They have their buddies that are AI buddies.
Yeah.
And they're invested in those. And in many cases, these young kids don't know how to talk to women. They don't know how to converse. But you know, it's easy to turn it on. And of course, all these bots are super, hey, good day, your question was awesome. They get flattered that way. But that is one heartbeat away from becoming, I was going to say living, breathing, becoming a fully automated, extremely realistic woman or man. And again, more women than men. Mm-hmm. I mean, they already half exist if you see some of that shit.
Yeah.
So when for money that's not outrageous, $8,000 to $10,000, you can buy, I'll just say a hot chick fix facsimile, something that would look and feel and God knows what you want to do with her. And she can talk to you and move around and please you. That will be not 10 years, but like 2 to 3 years, they say will be, that's where everyone's going. Which in a way is, I'm not saying this is good news, for people who've lucky enough to lived a longer life. But so what is entertainment anymore? The traditional feature, I believe, in the future as we know it, will be almost like theater is today. You know, there will be screens, there'll be people who appreciate it, they'll generally be older, there'll be the guys who make these event movies, you know, Christopher Nolan and Spielberg or Marvel, whoever it is. Yeah. But that's very limited. Far bigger will be 8 million ways to see a movie, to stream a movie, to download a movie, to implant a movie, to put goggles on, to look at the things. All that stuff is going to be. So it's a splintering in a million directions of entertainment of different shapes and sizes. So,
last question for you. What's the best movie you've ever made?
Oh, God. Oh, no.
And what's the worst movie you ever made, you think?
Oh, God. It's hard, you know, in a way, I've never pretended to be making amazing. I mean, I make fun entertainment. Mm-hmm. This is all this is. Never cracked up to be anything else. There's no real life lesson learned. It's like, you know, good guys usually win, so I'm on the side of that. But otherwise, they're just entertainment. So it's hard. And plus, a lot of them I'm close to because they've been part of my life.
Sure.
So it's like having 100,000 children. You can't say, well, Jimmy's really the awesome one. So I can't even, you know, I mean, all the movies that are kind of obvious are my, well, I would say the two movies that are out of the orbit of the franchises and movies that people would normally hear about or know are Head of the Family and Hideous. It's another one you've never heard of.
Mm-mm.
Both clever, both very unique. And one was shot 30 years ago, one maybe 15 years ago. I forget the dates. They could be shot yesterday. They're timeless. There's nothing in them to go, oh, that's kind of what they did. Or no. Just a timeless, two timeless movies. So I like those as kind of fun. But, you know, I'm very fond of Trancers, you know. It was great directing that with the great Tim Thomerson, who was a phenomenal actor and a good friend, and Helen Hunt, her first movie.
Yeah.
There's some of that stuff. But I want to be encouraging, even though the whole conversation is like, well, everything's kind of today, and there's no money, because people will find their way. You know, and I forget his name, with the kid who, at age 20, whatever, he did Obsession. I'm not sure if you heard about Obsession.
Backrooms.
Well, Backrooms, they were both in the same.
Yeah, the Backrooms kid is 20.
He's 20. Yeah. And the Obsessions kid, whoa, he's old. He's 25.
22 or something.
He's an antique.
Yeah.
I mean, that's encouraging that these kids from nowhere.
With low budget movies too.
Yeah, I mean, Obsessions, $750,000. Yeah. That's a little more than what we spent.
Right.
Well, we used to spend. Now we're not spending that. So when that happens, that just shows that talent somehow can rise to the top. And I think studios, not just for features, for everything, TV, streaming, whatever content is being created to try to make a buck, are much more aware that these younger kids have a lot of talent. That's where they need to go.
Yeah.
I mean, how many of these Marvel reboots can you sit through?
Well, yeah.
I was a fan. Hey, let me go see it. And then it's finally, oh, if it's the same movie.
Yeah.
And then they're 2.5 hours long.
Yeah.
90 minutes should be a rule.
Mm-hmm.
Not 1 minute over 90 minutes. Otherwise, what are you doing? You know, you hit on the head. Then there's 12 endings and everyone's blowing shit up and the guy gets hit 1,000. Oh my God. So yeah, let's give us more of those clever, tales that are fresh to the audience, not the same. I can't see another horror movie with the kids calling on the thing. It's like, we've seen this movie 1,000 times.
Well, it's great talking to you, Charles.
Great
true pioneer, and thanks for the swag.
Pioneer. Okay. Well, you got all sorts of weird shit.
The boo-boo, puppet master. It's amazing.
Well, you know, you have to do what you have to do, and all you guys keep on trucking, whatever's going on there, and really good meeting you.
Nice
and
to meet you.
All I've heard is Chris Jericho's an awesome dude.
Well, hopefully we lived up to the name.
Absolutely. All right.
Thanks, man.
As we say in my business, and cut.
Finn.
Finn. Just his cut.
Ha ha ha.